You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Katoa, ko joel toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wai Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whai akane, coming up on the show, for a weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about ACT MP Laura McClure's Members Bill proposing the disestablishment of the BSA, or Broadcasting Standards Authority, and the government's move to halt new puberty blocker prescriptions for young transgender people. Following on from my chat with Simon, I spoke to the Vice President of PATHA, the Professional Association of Transgender Health Aotearoa, and GP Specialist in Gender Affirming Care, Dr. Elizabeth McElroy, more about puberty blockers and how this temporary ban will affect transgender young people. I also spoke to the co-chair of Auckland Pride, Benjamin Goodsir, about the organisation's challenge to the High Court following the removal of transgender guidelines for the participation in community sports. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to senior lecturer in critical studies and education at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jude MacArthur, about the government's plans to introduce an expanded new curriculum for students with high and complex needs and what it means for their learning.
Hey, aho whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e ware ware e a hei ana koutou, te whakaronga ki ēnei kōrera anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā rongi te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Recently, ACT MP Laura McClure has launched a members' bill proposing the disestablishment of the BSA, or Broadcasting Standards Authority. I spoke to the Victoria University of Wellington's Peter Thompson last week on the bill, who said this bill would enable private media corporations to operate with impunity in pimping out propaganda and disinformation at the cost of and the cost of that would be a further erosion of our democracy. As well as this, recently the government has announced it will be halting new prescriptions for puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria pending a clinical trial in the UK, with the outcome of this trial set for 2031. This move has seen backlash from a variety of LGBTQIA+ organisations and health experts working in gender-affirming care who believe the move goes against the best interests of transgender youth. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about both of these topics, starting with Laura McClure's Members' Bill. To start, what is the reason for this Members' Bill?
Well, Laura's bill recognises that the world has changed, the world of media, the world of information. The Broadcasting Standards Authority was designed in the 1980s when we only had a handful of state-owned broadcasters, but now New Zealanders have endless choice. Radio, streaming, podcasts, social media. If you don't like what you're hearing, you can switch it off or switch channels. And so what Laura's bill is addressing is that the BSA essentially is a dinosaur and it's struggling to be relevant. Earlier this year, the BSA tried to extend its reach into online media. And in a free country, the ultimate broadcasting standard should really be the audience's own judgment. We don't need a taxpayer-funded bureaucracy policing taste and opinions online, do we?
Are there concerns within the party, though, that if this bill were to be pulled from the biscuit tin and passed, that we could see an increase in offensive and disturbing content and a spread of misinformation and disinformation in which the BSA regulates?
Well, like I said, the BSA regulates television and radio, and it was set up to police content when we only had state-owned broadcasters and people had wanted to be able to essentially point out where they thought the state-owned broadcaster, you know, the one source of truth, potentially had made an error. Fair enough, back in the 1980s and 90s, but we already have strong existing laws against defamation and obscenity, for example. We don't need a taxpayer-funded bureaucracy policing taste and opinion online, even if you don't agree with it or you think the information's not correct. Again, you know, more speech, free speech is the answer to wrong speech from ACT's perspective.
You mentioned those laws just then, and McClure also mentioned that there were laws already in place for defamation and obscenity. What are these laws, and how will they operate to, in a sense, overtake, if this bill is passed and taken out of the biscuit tin, what the BSA currently regulates?
Well, the BSA, look, I mean, when it comes to defamation, it's against the law. You can be, somebody can take a case against you if you defame them, if you damage their reputation, for example, by stating something about them that was untrue. And so that's separate to the BSA. And in terms of obscenity and harmful content, we already have laws around that, like Harmful Digital Communications Act, for example. So that's why in Laura's bill, it's very clear we don't need an additional taxpayer-funded bureaucracy policing primarily taste and opinion online. And in fact, if you think about what they do for television and radio, they do very little, and you know, people have an opportunity to change channels or simply switch it off if they don't like what they're hearing. The time for the BSA has come and gone. It's 2025. We don't need this dinosaur entity from the 1980s hanging around basically responding to complaints about taste and opinion.
Moving on to our next topic, we have also seen the government temporarily pause new prescriptions for puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria. How does the ACT Party feel about this move?
Well, we're pleased that the government is taking a precautionary and evidence-based approach, because the Ministry of Health's own evidence shows that research on puberty blockers for gender dysphoria is very limited. It's generally low quality, and it appears to have a high risk of bias. And because the benefits of these drugs are unclear, and there's real clinical questions around things like the way they affect bone density and metabolic effects on people who take these drugs, it makes sense to pause new prescriptions now while we rely on the UK completing a larger clinical trial, and we can just get some clearer answers.
Individuals suffering from conditions such as endometriosis, which includes minors in this case, and precocious puberty are still able to access puberty blockers to treat those conditions. Then what is the difference between young people accessing puberty blockers as gender-affirming care and those who aren't? If the reason for this temporary ban is a precautionary approach, as you just mentioned, and as what Health Minister Simeon Brown puts it, shouldn't there be an outright ban for everyone using puberty blockers?
Well, I think you've just made the point that they do have specific medical applications where there is evidence that they are beneficial, such as to treat endometriosis, then of course doctors and medical profession should be able to continue to prescribe them. I mean, that makes sense. But where there is very little evidence, or the evidence is of low quality, that prescribing puberty blockers for gender dysphoria, for people who feel they were born in the wrong body, well, that's, the government has said, look, let's wait and see what the clinical trials that the UK is doing show us, and then we can reevaluate.
You've touched on these clinical trials a bit, and these clinical trials came about because of the original CAT review that prompted the UK government to take on this clinical trial. But this original CAT review has received some concerns from organisations such as the Professional Association for Transgender Health Aotearoa. The president of that organisation, Jennifer Shields, at the time said the final CAT review did not include trans or non-binary experts or clinicians experienced in providing gender-affirming care in its decision-making, conclusions or findings, adding that multiple people involved in the review and advisory group had previously supported a ban on gender-affirming care in the US. Does this not set a dangerous precedent that the government is justifying their decision largely on this review?
Well, those people should therefore welcome the clinical trial that the UK is undertaking into these drugs and their use to treat gender dysphoria, this concept that people feel that they are born in the wrong body. Now, if it turns out that the clinical trial says, yes, this is the best way to treat this psychological condition, well, so be it. But I would have assumed that, that people would be welcoming such a trial rather than basically saying we shouldn't have it at all.
Instead, then, how will the government be supporting young transgender people with gender dysphoria instead of by allowing new puberty blocker prescriptions?
Well, we certainly, in terms of what the government is doing, we're making sure that, these young people do have access to mental health support. That should be the first port of call for anybody who feels, that they're not comfortable in their own skin, if they have anxiety or suffering from depression or many other things that certainly adolescents and young people grapple with as their bodies change and as their mind and as their brains develop, which can continue up to about the age of 25, but they do have support for all of the things that they're struggling with.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on ACT MP Laura McClure's BSA Members Bill and the government temporarily halting new puberty blocker prescriptions for transgender youth.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Alcohol is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay, it's BFM.
The Wire.
Following on from my chat with MP Simon Court, I spoke to Dr. Elizabeth McElroy, the Vice President of PATHA, the Professional Association of Transgender Health Aotearoa, and GP Specialists in Gender Affirming Care, about the government's temporary ban of puberty blocker prescriptions for transgender youth. Health Minister Simeon Brown says this move is a precautionary measure, as he says the evidence regarding puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria remains unclear. Despite this, puberty blockers will still be available for young people with conditions such as endometriosis and precocious puberty. I spoke to McElroy more about puberty blockers, the safety for young transgender people to be prescribed them as a form of gender-affirming care, and what halting prescriptions, at least until 2031, will mean for young people with gender dysphoria heading forward. As a general question, what are puberty blockers and how do they work?
So puberty blockers have been used for over 20 years for gender-affirming care. So puberty blockers work simply by pausing puberty for a young person who enters puberty and needs some time to think. So all they do is pause puberty. There are no side effects. There's very few side effects. They're very safe. They are they're reversible. And we know that they've been prescribed for over 20 years for this purpose. They only prescribe in New Zealand by expert clinicians who use the utmost care and consideration.
That kind of leans on to my next question, but what steps are required for a young person to access puberty blockers? Is it quite a rigorous process?
For many years, our clinicians have been using usually the informed consent pathway, which means a young person who presents needing or requesting access to care, usually a young transgender person who has started puberty, and they will usually have great distress as their body changes, and we go through a process of, with the family and with another mental health professional. We take a detailed history, we go through the goals for the young person and what they want to achieve. We discuss the options for treatment, including risks and benefits of all the treatments. And over the course of the next 3 to 6 months, we work really closely with an MDT, the family and the young person, to decide the best course of action. And once any prescription is given, if needed, we will continue to follow this person up every 3 months at least for the next few years.
How do puberty blockers compare to other forms of gender-affirming care?
So they're really life-saving for many young people. They are reversible. So all they do is pause puberty. They give the young person time to think and to grow and to decide what it is they want to do in the future or going forward, compared to other forms of gender-affirming care, such as hormones, which have irreversible effects as well, but they are usually for older children. And then we do have, gender-affirming care includes everything from using binders, using period cessation, everything. So they're only one tool in the toolkit of our experts using this.
Puberty blockers as a way of gender-affirming care have been practiced in the sector for, as you say, over 20 years. Why are we only seeing this temporary ban now?
Yeah, I know. It's really hard to understand. I think, obviously, there are politicians who have decided, based on the CAS review, which was released in the UK in 2024, that they are using this. And it has, to be honest, it has been weaponized as a tool to say, right, we're not sure about this treatment. So, and they're thinking, you know, they're basing it on the fact that we don't have high quality studies, but not all medicines, especially in pediatrics, are subjected to high quality studies because it's just not ethical to do that for children and for young people. So to know something is safe and to be widely used in practice is another form of evidence, along with patient preference for medication. So there are other ways of knowing something is safe without doing high quality, you know, what they class high quality trials. And it's also interesting to note that the CAST review did not state that puberty blockers should be banned. And many of the recommendations in the CAST review are also are already upheld in the gold standard care in New Zealand.
So would you say, do you believe this is a bit of a political move rather than what's in the best interests of young people with gender dysphoria?
Absolutely, 100%. This is a political decision. You know, how on earth can you explain that children who have precocious puberty, which is an early puberty, or have endometriosis, are allowed this care safely with no consideration, you know, of any concern? You know, whereas a child who is trans, because they're trans, are not allowed this care. So I would like to ask our politicians, well, how do we manage a young trans child who has endometriosis or early puberty? Are they allowed to access puberty blockers? And, you know, it has been very, very difficult, and I don't understand why our politicians are interfering in our practical, you know, in our clinical practice, and why political ideology has been used to inform legislation. I mean, this is a slippery slope for us if our politicians start to interfere with our clinical practice. I mean, what will they target next?
With this temporary ban of new puberty blocker prescriptions set to come into effect in December, has the government established pathways or advice young trans people on how to receive other forms of gender-affirming care and support?
Nothing, not at all. Not at all. There's been nothing to support these young people. There's been no increase in support. The Minister of Health discussed increasing mental health options and online resources, but we are already providing mental health support for these young people. That is only part of the picture. It's going to be detrimental to their health. We are going to see a dramatic rise in the experience of distress, of depression, anxiety, of social isolation, of discrimination. And we're, you know, going to see an increase in self-harm and suicide.
We'll touch more on the side effects of this temporary ban in just a second. But firstly, has the government engaged with health experts such as PATHA, such as yourself, in deciding on this temporary ban?
Oh, not at all. I mean, there was a consultation done before the position statement, which was released in November 2024, but not this year. We have been blindsided on the ban. I mean, the position statement stated that, you know, puberty blockers should be prescribed with great care and with great caution, and as part of a multidisciplinary team, which we were already doing, but there was absolutely no evidence that this medication was going to be banned.
What consequences could we see here for young transgender people who are denied access of puberty blockers, at least until this clinical trial in the UK ends in 2031?
Well, we're going to see, apart from the mental health impacts that we're going to see, we're also going to see them accessing drugs and medication illegally, overseas, online. And that is already happening. You know, the Minister of Health said that he didn't see any evidence for this, but he hasn't looked for evidence of this. And this often occurs in the setting of, you know, without clinical support. So young people and, I mean, the transgender community have been accessing medications illegally for decades because they've had to. I mean, they're a very well-researched community. But for our young people, having to access illegal medication is a really frightening prospect. And this will happen. I mean, if you cannot access medications yourself, and a medication that has been used safely for 20 years and is now being banned, you know, they're going to access other medication. They're going to get whatever they can to stop puberty or to pause puberty while they, you know, while they figure out what it is they want to do in the future. So that's one of the things I'm most worried about. I just want to say that I'm not sure why the New Zealand government feels that following UK standards and UK policy is correct for New Zealand. And I would just like to challenge them on that. I mean, the UK has not been a leader in this space, and they've also quoted the likes of Sweden and Finland and Norway as practicing in the way that they feel is appropriate. And I would like to challenge them on that as well.
That was PATHA's Dr. Elizabeth McCallaray on the government's decision to halt puberty blockers as a form of gender-affirming care and what this will mean for transgender youth heading forward.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Go Cooler Music is giving away a guitar. Want to win it? Just text Go Cooler to 5395, spelled G-O-K-U-L-A, along with your B-card number and your favourite guitar player or riff, and you'll be in the draw to win a Torquay Legacy guitar. Tune in to Dirtbag Radio Monday, December 1st. From 7 to 9 p.m. to hear Rapley draw the winner. Cheers, Go Cooler Music. 378 Broadway, Newmarket.
Garth! Garth! Where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no-hat, no-play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
The worms better watch their back.
Sometimes you need a bit of uns-uns.
That snooze button better be disarmed.
I like it. It's making my eyelid twitch. Love it.
And the wrong side of the bed better shuffle over.
And they're just so beautifully, like, menstrual.
Because we've got a little something for your gratitude journal.
Cowbella. 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 Cowbella.
It's the 95BFM Breakfast Show with your hosts, Rosetta and Millie. 7 till 10 every weekday. Thanks to 8:30 Coffee Roasters.
Original. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
stop drinking, maybe I could find you attractive. Maybe I could let you have it, and it happened. I asked him why he had these feelings. He said your tits and ass don't really hurt, and I think he really meant it. And now I'm wondering if I should let him. Let him in, why don't the good ones love me? Watching him fall, watching him go right in front of me. Let him in, why don't the good ones love me? Watching him fall, watching him go right in front of me.
Love me, why don't the good ones love me? Only narcissists dare to approach me. They're overconfident and getting comfy. Why don't the good ones love me? I'm too pretty, I'm too outspoken. I am broken, leave the place open. Good guys, and I stand at a mark. I stand above, like I'm playing with the doves. With the tellers in the bank, cut them up. Good guys, can you tell me what's up? What's down, wanna be my confidant? What vibe, when it's about a confide? Why don't the good ones love me? Why don't the good ones?
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was TNA by Blondshell and John Glacier, and before that was Blunt Force Trauma by Elias Ronenfeldt featuring Erica DeCassier.
Would you say that it could be an improvement?
I mean, no, you have to improve a piece of shit.
The Wire.
Recently, a lot of conversation has been had about the curriculum, with the government planning to roll out yet another new and expanded curriculum. This expanded curriculum, beginning in term one of next year alongside their general new curriculum, will seek to provide the tools for teachers to educate and assist students with high and complex needs who are otherwise ignored in the existing curriculum, or so the government claims. This comes against the background of this government's push for effective teaching and learning based on science. However, concerns remain about this curriculum. For starters, this curriculum exists separately to the rest of Aotearoa's student body. We seem to be getting one curriculum for those with complex needs and one for those without. This has led to questions about the role of inclusion in our education and what that means for our students. I spoke to Senior Lecturer in Critical Studies and Education at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jude MacArthur, about the separate curriculum, what it means for these students, and how it might affect their learning and inclusion. To get us started, what have we seen so far in terms of this expanded curriculum and the government's plans?
So we've had an announcement from the Minister to say that an expanded curriculum would be provided for students with complex needs. And in her announcement, Minister Stanford said that that would be the 12,000 students around New Zealand with complex needs. So my assumption would be that those students are the students who have ongoing resourcing funding for high and complex needs, right? So those children are in special schools, They are also in special classes in ordinary schools, and they are in their local schools. And obviously in smaller towns and rural areas, that's where the children will be, in the regular classroom with their peers. So at the moment, what I've been told is that expanded curriculum is only going to be for children with high and complex needs who are in special schools. But we haven't seen it yet. And so my question really is, the question that I've asked is, why do we need an expanded curriculum? Because an expanded curriculum for me suggests that this is confirmation that the New Zealand curriculum, the refreshed New Zealand curriculum, has not been written with every child in mind. And that's a backward step from our 2007 curriculum, which was indeed written for everybody.
And I mean, on that, when we look at how this curriculum might differ from that being rolled out for other students, what does it kind of mean in terms of the exclusion and how the rolled out curriculum might not account for these students?
Yeah, so we know that the refreshed curriculum, which I refer to as the Stanford curriculum, because it is actually different from work that was done between 2020 and 2023 on Te Mate Aho. So the new curriculum now that Minister Stanford has delivered under her leadership is called the New Zealand Curriculum Te Mate Aho. And it mentions inclusion. However, it also prioritises a knowledge-rich curriculum and science of learning. And so my question then would be around, well, what if we take that as the sort of overarching focus for everybody, how will disabled children's learning be recognised when the focus is on a narrow form of knowledge, it's on a narrow way of teaching? So teachers have been told, you will teach this type of knowledge, you will do it in this particular way, and we're waiting now to find out what is the assessment that's going to sit alongside that. So how will teachers recognise student learning? So my concern around the expanded curriculum is, well, first of all, what are we expanding? And what's that going to look like? If we go back in time to the 2007 curriculum, we have seen alternative versions of the New Zealand curriculum brought out for disabled children. And that curriculum was not based on New Zealand knowledge, understanding, culture, you know, opportunities for learning. It was based on overseas ideas about what disabled children need. It was also a very low-level curriculum. It was focused on children's learning below level one. So it doesn't take much for us to think about, you know, well, what sits behind that? What are the assumptions that sit behind that? And if we assume that children can't learn at level one and they've got to have a curriculum that's below level one, there is a very strong sense here that we don't believe in children's capability, but rather we see them through a deficit lens. And so our expectations for their learning are going to be quite low level. So my worry around any form of adapted curriculum or an expanded curriculum would be that it could come from a deficit orientation towards disabled children's learning, low expectations for their learning, and therefore, in terms of curriculum delivery, not giving those children the opportunities that they really need to learn well, to build on their strengths, to build on their interests, and so on.
And particularly in this context, but kind of wider as well, what does the science say about inclusion in education and how best to include these children in the wider curriculums?
If we look at what we know about inclusive education, we know that the best place to start, for a teacher to start, is to assume that child is capable and to build on, to learn about the child, to know that child well, to know their whānau, to gather as much information as you can about that child's strengths and their interests, and that becomes your starting point for teaching and learning. And we also know, you know, in terms of the research, that children who learn in their local school, in their local community, where those schools are well supported and well resourced, and where teachers are given the professional learning and the supports they need to include everybody well, the opportunities for those children's learning, for them to do that, for them to learn within the context of their local community and to be part of that community and grow up in that community, the outcomes for them both now as children and as adults are going to be far better than if they were segregated. I mean, these are not new ideas for us, are they? Because they are the very ideas that sat behind the deinstitutionalisation movement years ago. And so really what we're doing is just naturally taking those ideas and saying, well, you know, obviously children will learn best where they're in a place where they are seen as capable learners, as having strengths and interests, where they are alongside their peers, their brothers and sisters, and have that sense of belonging, you know, in their local school and in their local community. That will serve them well now and in the future.
And looking at both these curriculums and other changes that this government in particular has made towards education, what do these kind of say about the wider treatment of both neurodivergent and disabled students, but also tamariki and rangatahi Māori in our education space and how the government wants to approach them?
Well, it's a really difficult question to answer in a short space of time, but I'll do my best. I mean, you know, if you take the idea that this curriculum has been developed by around the ideas of a knowledge-rich curriculum, which is sort of a focus on a particular narrow form of knowledge, and around the science of learning, which is based on assumption that all brains are the same and we all learn in the same way, that is clearly going to be problematic in a diverse classroom. And so, you know, I mean, I'm speaking about disabled children here, and we know that in order for disabled children to learn well, we have to really understand them. We have to know what, I've already mentioned their strengths and interests, but we also need to know, you know, what are the effects of disability on them, how are we going to recognise and respond to the barriers that might get in the way of their learning. And those barriers could be physical, they could be about the classroom environment, they could be attitudinal barriers and so on. So all of those things need to be taken into account by a teacher when they're working with that child. You know, teachers also need to know, how am I going to use the additional supports I have in the classroom, like teacher aid? How do we do that well so that the child is not isolated away from their peers? And how do I work with other experts who can provide me with the knowledge that I might need around sort of therapies and integrating those into the child's day and so on? So you can get a sense of that being, you know, quite a complex set of ideas and activities and action, but all aimed at supporting that child to learn well. So in terms of the curriculum needs to take all of that into consideration. Now, if we say there's only one type of knowledge and we're saying to teachers, you must teach in this particular way and you must assess in this particular way, we are failing to take into consideration the diverse ways in which children learn and can show their learning. And that's my concern.
With that in mind then, just to kind of wrap up, what then should we be seeing from the government in terms of inclusivity in our education and in our curriculums?
So I wrote a piece about this and I pointed out that between 2020 and 2023, Te Mātai Aho, the underpinning framework for the refreshed curriculum, was written by a group of experts, Māori, Pacific, Tangata Tiriti, and people who work in inclusive education. And when you look at that document, many of the ideas that I've just been sharing with you now are documented there. So inclusion is explained. It's fully explained. Teachers have information in there which helps them to understand what inclusion is, how they put it into practice, and so on. And what it means in their day-to-day practice in the classroom with children and young people. That curriculum is also talks about giving effect to Te Tiriti o Waitangi. So the values and the ideas in there are very inclusive around children's cultures and obviously in Aotearoa New Zealand, our focus needs to be on Māori children and thinking about what kind of contexts are going to really support their learning in a way which is respectful of and responsive to their culture. Many of those ideas help us to understand what inclusive schools really look like in this country. And the beauty of that original document, Te Mātai Aho, was that it was all brought together in one place in one document. My suggestion to the Minister is that we should go back to that piece of work. That was a beautifully articulate piece of work. It was thoughtfully considered by people who were named, and it provides the foundation that we need for a truly inclusive curriculum. What we have now in this rewritten version has lost much of that sort of knowledge and information. It's still sitting there. The document is there. It was ready to go out to schools for the final consultation round, and then it was dropped when the new government came in. So my suggestion is that we go back to that, and that we recognise that the document that's replaced it is inadequate. It's full of oxymorons. It's full of ideas that simply do not work together. You can't say on the one hand that all children learn in the same way and that teachers must teach this way and then say that the curriculum is inclusive. Clearly that just does not make sense. So let's drop that and let's go back to the original Te Mātai Aho and work from there and start developing the documents that go with our learning areas with that foundational document in mind.
That was Senior Lecturer in Critical Studies and Education at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jude MacArthur, on the planned expanded curriculum for disabled and neurodivergent children and what it means for inclusion in the education system.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Burn in the wind. Drown all your sorrows in a tall glass of ale, they'll come back double fold. So drown all your washing in an old rusty pail, and when you breathe, don't inhale. Life will get better someday. So sit on your high horse
down, as long as you don't make a sound. But how can we hear if nobody's listening? Your ears have been locked and they've thrown away the key. Now you're well on your way. Life will get better someday.
Welcome back. That was Life Will Get Better Someday by Bikaranga, The District Sleeps Alone Tonight by the Postal Service, and before that was Heart Goes Blank by Phased on a Pony.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Auckland Pride has filed a High Court challenge following the Minister for Sports and Recreation, Mark Mitchell, advising the sports body, Sports New Zealand, to withdraw the entity's guiding principles for the inclusion of transgender people in a community sport. The organisation says that the move goes against the kaupapa of Sports New Zealand and that Mitchell had not considered legislation such as the Bill of Rights Act and Human Rights Act in deciding on removing the guidance for the inclusion of transgender people in community sports. I spoke to the co-chair of Auckland Pride, Benjamin Goodsir, about the organisation's High Court challenge. To start, what are the guiding principles for the inclusion of transgender people in community sport?
So the guiding principles were developed back between 2020 and 2022. There were a range of sports organisations that work in community sports that really wanted help understanding how best to include trans people in community sport. And so they worked with Sport NZ and a range of other groups to develop these guiding principles to offer really practical, useful tips and principles to help local organisations make community sports inclusive for trans people. And so those guidelines were published as the guiding principles, and that's what's been available for several years for community sports to make community sports somewhere where everyone is welcome.
What does the removal of these guidelines mean for transgender athletes wanting to play community sports?
Ultimately, it sends a signal that the government isn't going to be looking out for trans communities, and it also makes it harder for community organisations that are organising sports and the hundreds of volunteers that organise those events to make community sports accessible and inclusive for everyone. But it also really sends a signal that the government doesn't care to follow a good process in terms of upholding the law and upholding the human rights expectations that are on them to consider the rights of our trans communities when they make decisions as a government.
That kind of leads on a little bit to this next question, but were LGBTQIA plus organisations and even other sort of sporting organisations like community clubs engaged with prior to this decision?
So back when the guiding principles were first developed, LGBT organisations and sports organisations were consulted and helped create those guiding principles. Back in about 2024, the government initiated a review of the existing principles, but before that review could get to the stage where they consulted with community, the minister cancelled it and cancelled the guidelines. So there was no consultation with community over the cancellation of these guidelines.
And what about Sports New Zealand here? Did this entity have much of a say in this decision?
So this was a direction that was made to Sport NZ by the minister. Sport NZ has gone along with that decision, despite, in our view, it not aligning with their statutory obligations under the law. But ultimately, it was a decision made by the minister and followed through by the government organisation.
What are their statutory obligations under the law?
So Sport NZ's role is really to make sport and recreation and physical exercise something that everyone in New Zealand can be involved in. And they have some specific obligations to communities like women and disabled communities and other areas of New Zealand to really focus on ensuring they're involved. But ultimately, the remit of Sport NZ is to get everyone involved in sport and recreation in New Zealand and make it an inclusive space for community sports.
And I guess what counts as community sports in this space?
Community sport covers really an incredible range of things. It might be sort of mixed gender indoor netball on a Monday evening. It could be, you know, 5-year-olds having a kick around on the field on a Saturday morning. It is hundreds of different codes of sport all across the country, all ages, all genders. And it's really just the way that most people engage in sport in New Zealand. So there's no one way to be engaged in community sport. And actually that was recognised in the guiding principles because it offered flexible advice that could be applied to any of those codes rather than a rigid set of rules.
How does the removal of these guidelines interact with legislation such as the Bill of Rights Act and the Human Rights Act and even things like Te Tiriti o Waitangi?
The minister has an obligation to make decisions that are consistent with the Human Rights Act, with the Bill of Rights Act, and with Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And so as a part of preparing for this case, we asked the minister point blank, did you consider any of these pieces of legislation or fundamental principles in our legal framework? And he told us no, that there was no consideration, no advice sought, and that's just not acceptable for a ministerial decision.
What are you hoping comes out of Auckland Pride's High Court challenge?
We want this decision to go back to the minister's desk, and we want the minister to go get that advice. We want him to understand how does this decision actually impact the human rights of rainbow and trans communities, and how does it impact local sports organisations that just want to make community sports fun and inclusive for everyone, and then make that decision once he's got all of the evidence on the table. Because this has been a very divisive issue and there have been lots of people overseas trying to score points and take trans communities down a peg or two. And so what we think is really needed in this is good evidence-based decisions that consider the human rights of trans communities. And we think if the minister considers all of those factors, it will be very clear to him the decision he needs to make.
This High Court challenge has seen the support of various LGBTQIA plus organisations, including Rainbow Youth, Inside Out Kuaro, Qtopia, Te Nako Kahukura and Mana Aniwaniwa, as well as a variety of academics and leading voices in sports inclusivity. How can people show support for this kaupapa?
Rainbow Youth has been working really closely with us and they are pulling together an open letter to the minister in support of both this action and the guiding principles for trans inclusion in community sports. And if you head along to their website at ry.org.nz/reinstate, you can sign up to that open letter and show your support and send a message of support to trans and rainbow communities there.
That was the co-chair of Auckland Pride, Benjamin Goodsir, on the organisation's High Court challenge regarding the removal of transgender guidelines for participation in community sport.
Hey, I'm Paddy Gower, and this is F***ing BFM.
That was The Wire.
Koira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, the Professional Association of Transgender Health Aotearoa's Dr. Elizabeth McElroy, the University of Auckland's Dr. Jude MacArthur, and Auckland Pride's Benjamin Goodsir. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.